Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Healthy Skeptic Podcast. My name is Danny Roddy of DannyRoddy.com, and with me is Chris Kresser, health detective and owner of ChrisKresser.com, a blog challenging mainstream myths about nutrition and health. Chris, how are you doing, buddy?
I'm great, Danny. How are you? How's Hawaii?
It's amazing. I can't ask to spend any more time sitting in the sand looking at the water. It's amazing.
Yeah, I admit to some mild jealousy at the moment. I feel like I've been a hermit for the past 6 weeks, and it's been amazing spending that time with my daughter. But I have my typical routine at this time of the year is to be out in the sun a lot and surfing and things like that. But it's been more, you know, along the changing diapers line lately.
Well, to be honest, I've been looking forward the whole trip to interviewing our special guest.
We've got Chris Masters on here, back for part two of the cholesterol special. We're really happy to have him back. The first show was that we did with him was one of our most popular shows ever, and people have been really excited to hear the second part. So Chris, why don't you tell us, why don't we do like a 2-minute synopsis of the last show, just for people who might have missed it so they're not completely lost. And then we're going to talk a little bit about just some more basics about cholesterol that we didn't get to during the last show. And then we're going to answer a few questions. So why don't you take it from here, Chris?
All right. Sounds great. Thank you so much. It's great to be here again, Chris and Danny. Thanks for having me on a second time. So last time we talked about whether cholesterol plays any role in heart disease, and of course the roles of cholesterol in the body. Cholesterol does a lot of important things. It's the precursor to sex hormones, highly related molecules, the precursor to vitamin D. It's the precursor to bile acids, which help our digestion and so on. But, you know, our big concern is, does cholesterol cause heart disease? And when we go to the doctor and we get our blood lipids measured, does that have any significance for us? And there seem to be two different camps where, you know, we have the mainstream that says cholesterol is one of the most important causes of heart disease. When its level in the blood rises, that cholesterol just kind of bursts into the arterial wall and causes an atherosclerotic plaque. And some of these people, even, you know, the Nobel Prize winning scientists like Michael Brown and Joseph Goldstein call themselves cholesterol warriors because they're making a war on cholesterol.
Oh boy!
Then we have the opposite side of the spectrum, which are the cholesterol skeptics, and they say no, these blood lipids don't really have anything to do with heart disease, and so they say this idea that they do, the lipid hypothesis, is just totally false. And so what I presented in the last show was basically an attempt to reconcile the evidence that's used on both sides of this argument. And what I like to say is that the infiltrative lipid hypothesis is false, but the degenerative lipid hypothesis would be a good term for what the science is leading us towards. And the reason I use those words is because when the role of blood lipids in heart disease was first discovered in the cholesterol-fed rabbit model, Nikolai Anichkov, who basically brought that model to fore, said, look, it's not about degeneration of the arterial wall. It's about this high concentration of lipids in the blood that's infiltrating the blood vessel wall. Mm-hmm. And last time we talked about all the evidence that suggests that it is lipid related, so we should have some type of lipid hypothesis, but it's not about the high concentration, it's not about the high amount, it's about the degeneration of those lipoproteins in the blood that are carrying those lipids. So what we want to do is not seek how to lower the concentration of lipids necessarily, but we want to seek how to prevent the degeneration of those lipids. And we briefly talked about the need to maintain robust thyroid hormone status and good metabolism, the need to get sufficient nutrients to minimize the degeneration of these lipids, mm-hmm. and the need to minimize inflammation, infection, and other toxic factors that contribute to their degeneration. So that's the basic rundown of the last show.
Right. Yeah, so he got a lot of things right, but he got that one key point wrong. And that seems to have set off a whole, have set us on a path that has really distorted what we know now to be true.
Absolutely, because of this, the simple reason that there are some things that, relative to other things, might raise the concentration of cholesterol in the blood, but those things are sometimes things that are actually really good for us when we look at the bottom line.
Yeah, and I think that's what's been confusing about this for some people is that neither of the extremes are right. There's a little bit of truth on both sides, and so it's been really difficult to tease out exactly what we can determine from the scientific literature, at least the current scientific literature. So let's talk a little bit about what a quote normal cholesterol would be, and what do anthropological studies from various traditional cultures around the world tell us about this, Chris?
That's a great question, and I think to even ask it goes back to the idea that Weston Price put forward when he traveled around the world looking at traditional healthy peoples, and he was looking at tooth decay, and he was saying, everyone in this society basically has degenerating teeth. I need to find people who are healthy, people who don't have tooth decay. And he also took the idea that, if we can find people who have superior development compared to what we have in our own society, then this can offer us standards of excellence. So I think we can apply the same thing to heart disease. One, we want to find, are there populations out there that don't have heart disease? And if so, what do they look like? We want to know what they're eating. We want to know what they're doing, how they're living. And we want to know what their cholesterol levels are, because maybe that can tell us something about what a normal cholesterol level is.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to establish them as standards of evidence, because people may say, look at people in our society and say, well, anyone who lives as long as we do or who is going to die of heart disease eventually because they're going to die of something. So if we can establish that there are people out there who are living reasonably long lives and are still free of heart disease, then we've established a new standard of excellence. And that just provides us with the basic fact that it is possible to live a long, healthy life and be free of heart disease. And if we look around the world, we see quite often researchers have documented that with the nutritional transition to modern diets, rich in refined foods, we clearly see this increase in degenerative diseases, including heart disease. And in many cases, there has been at least some investigation showing that traditional peoples before this transition to refined foods seem to have either a low rate of heart disease or freedom from heart disease. Now, I think among the groups that I've seen studied so far, it seems that two really stand out in terms of the extent to which they were investigated, and those are the Maasai and the Katavans. I think each of these groups of people was studied quite intensively, and what's particularly amazing about them is that they have very different cholesterol levels when you look
mm-hmm.
at them.
Mm-hmm.
So the Maasai, for example, are a pastoralist or cattle herding tribe who occupy a piece of land that crosses the border of Tanzania and Kenya in East Africa. And they traditionally raise cattle for subsistence, to eat the meat, drink the milk, and the other products that come from them, and also to trade for other products. And so they have a diverse diet that varies through the seasons of the year, and that also varies year to year according to the economic times, because they'll trade with other groups when their own supply of food is low or other groups are particularly wealthy. And at other times, they might have just tons and tons of milk, and they might focus mostly on consuming the milk. In any case, the Maasai have very low cholesterol levels, some of the lowest in the world. And a number of groups had studied them in the 1960s and shown that the men tended to have cholesterol levels between 130 and 135 milligrams per deciliter, which is, by our standards, we would say that's quite low.
Extremely.
And
yeah.
the women had somewhat higher cholesterol levels of about 145, and these would tend to rise with age, maybe to 170 milligrams per deciliter in their 40s and then drop off a little bit as they grew older. And it also seemed to rise quite a bit in the third trimester of pregnancy, at least according to one study. Women who were in the third trimester of pregnancy had their cholesterol levels go up to 205 milligrams per deciliter. But on the whole, they had very low levels of cholesterol with a population mean of around 130, 140. And their LDL to HDL cholesterol ratio was about 2. So that's considered quite good, even, you know, by American standards. So the medical establishment in our society would love the Maasai because they seem to support the lipid hypothesis. They have a very low or no rate of heart disease, and they have very low cholesterol levels. But if we look at the Catawbans who live in the Pacific Islands and are horticulturalists, we see something very different. This group is living off of a little bit of fish, a little bit of coconut, a lot of tubers, a little bit of fruit, and they have a very low fat intake, very high intake of saturated fat from coconut. And their cholesterol levels are not through the roof by our standards, but they're much higher than the Maasai. So the males, for example, tend to have cholesterol levels around 180 milligrams per deciliter. The females, again, are a bit higher, 200 to 210 milligrams per deciliter. Here we're pushing, you know, over the limit of what's considered healthy in our society. And during the their 40s or 50s, women might see cholesterol levels rise to about 250 milligrams per deciliter and then settle off again a little bit. And a lot of the Catawbans smoke, and their LDL to HDL cholesterol ratio is 3.3 among the smokers and 2.5 among the non-smokers. Mm-hmm. And we also have triglyceride information from them. It tends to be around 100, 110 milligrams per deciliter. Now, the Catawbans have been investigated very extensively. There are some other people in the Pacific Islands who we've had smaller investigations that seem to indicate that they're free of heart disease, but they're really too small to say definitively. Nevertheless, on some of these islands, we see even higher cholesterol levels traditionally. So on if we compare Puka Puka and Tokelau, who occupy Polynesians who also occupy Pacific Islands, the Puka Pukans have a high intake of starches and other carbohydrates and a fairly meaningful intake of coconut. On Tokelau, they have a much higher intake of coconut. And we see on Puka Puka, we have men going from cholesterol levels around 150 to 180 with age, but the women going from about 170 to 190 with age. But if we compare similar people eating more coconut, who also seem to be free of heart disease, we see men with cholesterol levels going 180 to 220 over their lifespans, and women going from 200 to 245 over their lifespans. So if we look at these populations, I would say we have a range. I'm not satisfied with the idea that low cholesterol is intrinsically unhealthy. I'm willing to consider it, but I would say that the Maasai should constitute the low range of what we might say is possibly healthy, and the Catawbans should probably serve as our high range. And I think we could probably say that anything between maybe 140 and 220, maybe going a little bit higher to 250, might constitute what seems to be normal. And I would caution that the Maasai, we don't know exactly why their cholesterol levels are so low, but Paul Jaminet has been doing a series on the role of infectious diseases, and we should note that infectious diseases are quite common in Africa, so that might play a role. Mm-hmm. So it might give us more comfort to say maybe a little bit higher than that, 160 or 180. But still, we don't really see healthy populations going through the roof in the high 200s or over 300. So that seems to constitute what we can say is normal.
Right. And it does depend, as we've been discussing, I think somewhat on the context, right, Chris? I mean, someone could have a cholesterol of 200, but they could be relatively unhealthy and at risk for heart disease, whereas someone else perhaps has a cholesterol of 220, 230, and they may be at still relatively low risk of heart disease, depending on their lifestyle and diet and several other factors. So it's not so cut and dry that if you're in that range, you get a hall pass from heart disease. But
absolutely. I mean, if you really want a good example of, you know, there's this myth floating around that because the Framingham study didn't find anyone with cholesterol levels under 150, that's the freedom from heart disease range. And that's just not true. If you look at these people with the PCSK9 gene mutations, right, who have really high LDL receptor activity, there's been one of them who's been found who did develop heart disease, and his cholesterol was somewhere around 50 or 60 milligrams per deciliter. Mm-hmm. But he also has smoked. He had high blood pressure. He had high LP little a through the roof, and so on. So that's absolutely true. And we have to realize that when we look at these cholesterol levels, they're not diagnostics. You know, it's heart disease we want to avoid. It's, you know, the any of the mental problems, the tendency towards suicide and anxiety that comes with low cholesterol. These are things that we want to avoid. But we always have to remember that there can be many things that lower cholesterol and many things that raise cholesterol. And some of those things can be good and some of them bad. So if we're lowering cholesterol because we're clearing it into an atherosclerotic plaque, that's clearly bad. If we're lowering cholesterol because we're converting it into sex hormones and bile acids and things that increase our fertility, virility, strength, and digestion and all these positive things, then it's clearly good to lower cholesterol. But if it's low because we're not making it, then we don't have those substances that we need to make all those good things. So that's clearly bad. So we can never judge by the amount of cholesterol in the blood alone, but we have to use it perhaps as a clue to try to understand with further investigation what's happening in the body.
Right. So Chris, you know, we talked a little bit on the last show about the difference in particle size, you know, small dense LDL particles versus large buoyant LDL particles, and what the relevance of that is to heart, you know, cardiovascular disease risk. And as you know, there's these tests out there like the VAP test or the NMR test that purport to measure particle size. And early on in my practice, I was using these tests to get an idea of particle size, but then I read several papers which suggested that these tests might not be as accurate as they were made out to be, and I think I sent you some of those papers. So what have we learned in the last few years about the accuracy of these particle size tests?
Well, what I learned, Chris, from the papers that you sent me is that if I want to have particle A, large, fluffy LDL particles, pattern A, excuse me, then the best thing that I can do is not change my diet, but it would simply be to measure my LDL particle size by tube gel electrophoresis, because 80% of people who measure their particle size by tube gel electrophoresis are classified as pattern A, whereas only 8% of people who use the VAP test or the VAP test are classified as pattern A. So the best thing that you can do to give yourself pattern A is to avoid using the VAP test, number one. And number two, if you can really avoid NMR or gradient gel electrophoresis and go for tube gel electrophoresis, that's really your best bet.
Good idea. Where can they get this done? So,
I don't want to, yeah, I think the point that this is raising is there's a lot of disagreement between these different tests, and until we get the science to the point where we can actually agree on the particle size, you know, on what test we use, on what standards we use to classify someone as having this or that particle size or this or that size distribution, I really don't think we're at the point yet where we should be ordering these tests for everyone and telling them to change their diet or to do this or that thing in order to alter their particle size. So I think, you know, this goes back to a more fundamental question, which is, why do we even care about the particle size in the first place? And I think we need to look at the foundation for that hypothesis. So the main reason that this came to the fore was because there were some early studies. First, there were retrospective studies, meaning looking at people who already had heart disease and just seeing what their particle sizes were. And we saw that people who had the larger particle sizes seemed to have a much lower prevalence of heart disease. Now, this is a good observation for generating hypotheses about what the role of these different particle sizes of LDL might play in cardiovascular disease risk. But to simply have a hypothesis doesn't really cut it. We want to really understand whether we're actually diagnosing something, or if we're not diagnosing something, are we getting a metabolic clue? Are we helping ourselves to understand what's going on in this person's body, or are we not? Now, if we want to argue that the small, dense LDL is associated with cardiovascular disease, the first thing we would want to do is verify that it's a predictor in prospective studies. In other words, if we measure people's particle size now, can we predict whether they develop heart disease in the future? And even these studies have led to some very, at best, ambiguous results.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a number of these studies, and most of them did show that particle size, whether measured by gradient gel electrophoresis, NMR, or in one case it was estimated by the ApoB to LDL cholesterol ratio. And the logic of that test is you have one ApoB protein per particle.
Right.
So if you have a higher ratio of particles to cholesterol, then presumably you have more small, dense particles rather than fewer large, mm-hmm. buoyant particles. Now, all of these different methods did have some success in predicting cardiovascular disease. But in most of these studies, when they were adjusted for traditional risk factors, the predictive power was mostly lost. Perhaps the most successful study I've seen was the Quebec cardiovascular study, where they used gradient gel electrophoresis. And they found that if they looked at the distribution of particle size, it was an independent predictor of heart disease risk. But a number of other studies that came after that failed to bear this out. So the Stanford Five City Project, for example, showed that particle size was useful, but once they adjusted for the total to HDL cholesterol ratio, it wasn't useful anymore. Mm-hmm. The Physicians Health study showed that particle size was useful, but once they adjusted for triglycerides and total cholesterol, it wasn't useful anymore. The Epic Norfolk study measured by NMR, and they found that particle size was useful, but they found that particle number was much more useful. But when they adjusted particle number for HDL cholesterol and triglycerides, once again, its usefulness was very questionable. And there was another study, the AMORIS study, the apolipoprotein-related mortality risk study, and that looked at particle size estimated by the ApoB to LDL cholesterol ratio. And once again, it seemed useful at first, but once they adjusted it to triglycerides or to ApoB, it lost its usefulness. And then finally, in the Women's Health study, they also looked at particle size with NMR, and once again, it lost its usefulness after adjusting for the total to HDL cholesterol ratio.
Chris, so, at the risk of stating something obvious here, I mean, how much can we rely on these studies since they're all using methodologies that we've just established are totally in disagreement with one another and not reliable?
Well, right, this is the thing. If we can't agree on how to quantify the particle size, then we can't necessarily agree that these studies are showing that particle size isn't useful. But at the same time, what meaningfulness does that question have?
Right,
the average person who's walking into the office and wants a test.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, are you gonna get into some really esoteric academic argument about? This test isn't going to do anything for you, but theoretically, it could be an imperfect measurement of something out there that does have meaning for
right.
you. You know, I mean, where are you getting with that?
Yeah,
you're going nowhere.
We can neither prove that particle size is not an issue nor prove that it is an issue with the current test because all of that rests on methodology that hasn't been standardized.
Exactly. So this is where particle size is useful. The studies that have somewhat ambivalently but nevertheless shown some relationship between particle size and cardiovascular disease risk have left us with several hypotheses that are worthy of investigation. One is that small, dense LDL is more likely to oxidize and thereby contribute to plaque development. Mm-hmm. Another is that it's more likely to pass through the endothelium and thereby oxidize behind the, because it's behind the blood vessel wall and contribute to plaque development. Another is that it's more likely to get stuck behind the blood vessel wall and thus contribute to plaque development. And my perspective is, I've pointed this out in several places, and I believe I mentioned it in our previous interview, it could also be seen as a marker for poor LDL receptor activity and LDL oxidation, because what happens when LDL hangs out in the blood? Well, it becomes small and dense because it's metabolized by a number of different enzymes that make mm-hmm. it small and dense. And because when it oxidizes, it becomes even more small and dense.
Right.
So here we have about four different hypotheses that are worthy of investigation, none of which have been confirmed. So it's highly questionable that we should be going around batting people over the head and say, make sure you do this, this, and this, and this to modify your particle size.
Right. Yeah, I've seen some people, just, you know, some patients who've come to me and also chatter on the internet, on my blog and other blogs, going to extreme lengths to try to adjust their ratio, you know, as measured by a VAP test or an MR test.
Yeah, absolutely. I will say this. I mentioned as I ran down these list of studies that the traditional risk factors like triglycerides and total to HDL cholesterol ratio were the factors that seemed to mitigate the usefulness of these tests, which brings us back to the question, are these tests any useful? Should you measure your total cholesterol or your HDL cholesterol? And I will say that we have many more studies addressing this topic, so we're able to amass a much larger data set and better answer the question. And we also have some, and not that it's without questions, but we have some better agreement on what tests to use to measure these things.
Mm-hmm.
And there is good data suggesting that there is, at a population level, in the general population, there is predictive value to some of these blood lipid markers, and that the best of them is the total to HDL cholesterol ratio. So if we look, for example, at two meta-analyses that were published in the last few years, one was the Emerging Risk Factors Collaboration, and that was published in the Journal of American Medical Association in 2009. And they showed that triglycerides, fasting triglycerides, HDL cholesterol, and non-HDL cholesterol were all useful predictors. But if they adjusted triglycerides for the other predictors, triglycerides lost their significance. But if they adjusted HDL and non-HDL cholesterol for triglycerides, non-HDL and HDL cholesterol persisted in their predictive power. And there was another study, the Prospective Studies Collaboration, which pooled together results from 61 studies with 900,000 participants that was published in The Lancet in 2007. And they found that if you looked at total cholesterol, HDL cholesterol, or LDL cholesterol, or any of the ratios, it was the total to HDL cholesterol ratio that really stood out as the best predictor. Now, what can we learn from that? Well, can we use the total to HDL cholesterol ratio as a diagnosis? No, a high ratio is not a disease. A low ratio is not a disease. Can we use it to predict risk? Yes, we can at a population level, not at an individual level. I think it's a logical fallacy to say a population with this mean has such and such a risk. Therefore, if you have that same value, you have such and such a risk. Mm-hmm. I think that's bogus reasoning.
And it comes up a lot in a lot of different markers. I mean, the hemoglobin A1C is another example of that. It's really useful on a population level, but it's not so useful individually because there are so many different markers that can affect red blood cell turnover, which is part of that formula. And so it's, you know, it's really not that useful for individuals.
Absolutely. There are many things that can affect the total HDL cholesterol ratio. But now the last thing is, does that mean it has no usefulness? Can we use it in some way as a metabolic clue? And I think that we can. But I don't think that it should ever be used without further investigation to see if that ratio goes out of whack. Why is it going out of whack?
Mm-hmm.
So And the reason that I think it's valuable is especially because, say we're talking, I mean, you recently commented, for example, I think this was on Twitter, you were talking about how, you know, people, you see so many people with low thyroid levels, and you think it's, and Emily Deans was saying she doesn't see that many people with low thyroid levels. So why is this? Well, you say you're getting a lot of these people who go all these different places and finally come to you because they no one else is helping them. Well, so we have to keep in mind that if we're trying to reach out to people who are seeing mainstream doctors, for a lot of those people, these are the only things that they're testing.
Right.
So when they go to the doctor's not measuring their hepatic triglycerides. The doctor's not measuring their free T3. I've gone to a doctor and said, can you give me a full thyroid panel with TSH, free T3, free T4? He says, sure. And then the test comes back and it has TSH on it.
Right.
So, So your average person going to the doctor, this is what they're getting. So when they go onto some internet forum and their total cholesterol has gone up to 350 and their HDL cholesterol is really low, and they get a bunch of people saying, oh, these things don't have anything to do with anything, they're not causal factors, just ignore it. That might be fine advice if their doctor had also measured this battery of things that you measure when patients walk into your office, mm-hmm. but they're not.
Right.
So for those people, I think we need to say this needs some follow-up. Let's see if this is going out of whack because of your thyroid. Let's see if this is going out of whack because you have insulin resistance, you have fatty liver. Let's try to look at these further issues. And that's where I think the blood lipids come into usefulness.
Yeah, I agree completely. And I mean, my standard answer kind of, and I know, I imagine it's similar to yours, is when someone says, is that cholesterol a problem? Is my cholesterol a problem? I say, I don't know. or maybe, or it depends. And it definitely requires a lot more investigation. And as you pointed out, unfortunately, that's rarely done in the conventional model. It's high cholesterol, you get a statin. Just right. Like when it's, you know, low, high TSH or low T3, you get thyroid hormone. Looking into the mechanism.
Exactly. So I think those of us who are in the know, who understand that there's a lot more to the picture, our response has to be exactly what you said. I don't know. Let's look at the big picture.
Mm-hmm. So Chris, there's a question that just comes up all the time in the blogosphere, and it's this question of why is my cholesterol so high after adopting a nutrient dense, you know, whether we're talking about a paleo or a Weston A. Price style diet that's higher in saturated fat. So, you know, there's been a lot written about that. Paul Jaminet, in fact, just wrote an article about this question yesterday, and he's been blogging about it recently. You've written about it. Can we do a little summary of the possible factors there? And then as a corollary, you know, is it something that people need to be concerned about when their LDL cholesterol goes up on this type of diet?
Absolutely. But let's outline, how do we know that it's actually gone up? Because quite often there are some confounding factors, or people don't realize how much they can expect these values to fluctuate, mm-hmm. Just on a regular basis. So, for example, let's say I went and got my cholesterol tested once while I was on diet A, and it's 180 milligrams per deciliter. And I get it tested once when I'm on diet B, and it's 200 milligrams per deciliter. Can I conclude that it's gone up since I've been on diet B? And the answer is an emphatic no. You cannot conclude that it's gone up. And this is the reason. There is very large fluctuation in total cholesterol, LDL cholesterol, HDL cholesterol, the ratio, and triglyceride levels just on a week-to-week or month-to-month basis without making any dietary changes. And studies that have been done to try to address the question, if we keep diet and lifestyle constant, how much can we expect this to vary if we make these measurements several times over the course of several months? And these are the basic answers. We can expect a single person to have a standard deviation in their total cholesterol of about 17 milligrams per deciliter. Now, what does this mean? Well, it means that if we haven't done anything to assess, for example, my individual variation over time, we should assume that if you measured my cholesterol 100 times, you'd find some true mean, some true average cholesterol level. But we could expect, without any changes, it to go up about 2 standard deviations, so about 35 milligrams per deciliter, or down about 35 milligrams per deciliter for no reason at all.
That is a huge range.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So and that could be the difference between statin or no statin, just depending on what day somebody chose to go into the doctor's office.
Exactly. So when you go into the doctor's office and your LDL cholesterol has gone up 30 milligrams per deciliter and your doctor says, oh no, your cholesterol is going up so much, you need Lipitor, the best answer for that is not, yeah, but what's my particle size? I bet it's a bit large and fluffy. Mm-hmm. The best answer for that is, did you know that the standard deviation of the intra-individual variation in one person can be 17 milligrams per deciliter and that this is within the range and you do not have 95% confidence that my cholesterol level has even increased since the last time I came up here? Perhaps you should go look at this, and this study. So here's the general rule. If your cholesterol, if you've only measured it 2 times, you should expect to see an increase or a decrease greater than 35 milligrams per deciliter before you can be 95% confident that your cholesterol has increased or decreased. You should expect your HDL cholesterol to go up either 9 or 10 milligrams per deciliter or down 9 or 10 milligrams per deciliter before you can say with 95% confidence that it's increased or decreased. You can expect your LDL cholesterol levels to go up either 30 milligrams per deciliter or down 30 milligrams per deciliter before you can conclude that that it's different. If you're looking at the ratio, you should expect the ratio of LDL to HDL cholesterol or total to HDL cholesterol to go up by 0.8 or down by 0.8 before you can conclude it's changed. And you should expect your triglycerides to go up by at least 40 milligrams per deciliter or down by at least 40 milligrams per deciliter before you can conclude that they've changed.
Wow. Okay? I mean, talk about problems with testing. I mean,
exactly.
Like, I have a little N equals one story about this because I recently, you know, being a new dad, decided to get life insurance. And, you know, I had to take this test of my lipids. And I knew I wasn't obviously going to be able to convince the insurance company, no, really, if my cholesterol is a little high, it's not a problem. It you know, it's all about oxidized LDL. That's obviously wasn't going to happen. So, being a clinician, I just ordered some tests for myself as, you know, the time was approaching to see where I was at, because the better the numbers are, the better the rate. And I was buying a 10-year policy. So the first time I tested my cholesterol, it was 185, I think, my total, which was significantly lower than it was the last time I tested it 6 months ago. And I thought, okay, that's fine. And then I tested it again a couple of weeks before the test, and it was 220. And I thought, oh, okay, my rate's going to go up. So I didn't make any changes because I was aware of this research too. And then I tested it the day before the test, and it was 193. And then I took the test the very next day, and then they just mailed me the results yesterday, and it was 205. Which incidentally was under their cutoff, so I got the good rate. But that's just a
congratulations.
That's a single person example of, and that was over only like a 4-week period.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the kind of variation you can expect for biological reasons. I'm citing these values on variation, by the way, from studies where they used the same method at the same lab. From these people, where they analyzed the samples in duplicate, showing that the actual variation due to the lab assay was very small, like 1 or 2%, right. And that most of this variation is biological. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, in order to conclude that it's even changed outside of your normal variation when everything's staying the same, those are the large kind of values that you need. Now, the second thing you need to – the one exception to this, by the way, would be if you had an average while you were on one diet and you had measured it 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 times – and then you do the same on a new diet, then you have a sense of your own variation, so you can compare them.
Right.
But in the absence of that, you just measured a couple times, once on an old diet, once on a new diet, that you need really large changes to conclude something's different. Now, the second thing is, I often get these questions from people who say, I went on this diet and my triglycerides went through the roof, my this or that went through the roof. And I say, one of the first questions I'll ask these people is, did your weight change? And quite often they say, oh, yeah, that's true. And here's the thing. There's really no good research I've seen so far about the effects of weight loss, fasting, and caloric reduction on blood lipids. There are a lot of fairly poorly designed studies, and I've reviewed a lot of them, and they're at wild conflict with one another. But this is what I've basically concluded as a tentative working hypothesis. If you are obese or overweight, and you normalize your weight and normalize all your metabolic parameters, you should expect in the long term, after your weight has stabilized, your blood lipids to mostly improve according to the conventional paradigm of risk factors.
Mm-hmm.
But in the meantime, what happens? Well, this is, I mean, triglycerides are especially sensitive to fasting. You know, when you eat a meal, your triglycerides are going to go up. Your triglycerides are always going to be lowest when you've been fasting in the morning. So especially with triglycerides, you always want to measure them the same time of day and always in the same amount of fasting since your last meal. So that's another confounder. But what happens when someone fasts for a long period of time to their triglycerides? Well, the answer is it depends. Usually, because you don't have food in your system, your triglycerides are going to get cleared over the course of a day of fasting or so. But what also happens is you need to start burning your own energy stores. So when you start to shift towards burning fat from your adipose stores, you start releasing free fatty acids into the blood. Now, these free fatty acids basically have three important fates. One is they go to the liver. The liver burns them for energy. The liver makes ketones, so the rest of your body can burn them for energy. But two other things happen in the liver. One, those free fatty acids can interfere with certain signals. For example, they interfere with thyroid hormone signaling. And as we know, especially in the blogosphere recently, and as we talked about last time, interfering with thyroid hormone signaling itself can affect blood lipids. But here's the other thing. If the liver's capacity to burn the fatty acids for energy is overwhelmed, the liver makes triglycerides out of them and sends the triglycerides back into the blood.
Mm-hmm.
So one person who has a very high capacity to burn fatty acids for energy might see their triglycerides go down as they're losing weight. But another person who's releasing more fatty acids from their adipose tissue than their liver can handle might see their triglycerides go up as they lose weight.
I'm sorry. What type of fatty acids were those that inhibited thyroid function?
The free fatty acids.
There's good preliminary evidence that any unsaturated free fatty acids are quite good at inhibiting thyroid function. And it's not just PUFAs. It's even oleic acid is pretty good at it. And there's really nothing you can do to suppress oleic acid in your body because you can make it yourself. But PUFAs also play a role. It's just that you have a lot more oleic acid. So basically any release of free fatty acids is probably going to inhibit thyroid signaling. And the best evidence for this is at the level of thyroid binding to the nuclear receptor and then binding to DNA. It seems that the concentrations of free fatty acids do get high enough in the nucleus of the cell to inhibit signaling there, and that will not be reflected by free T3 levels in the blood or anything like that. So it would be very difficult to detect it clinically. But it's probably a fact during weight loss or during any kind of dieting that leads to large increases in free fatty acids. So here's the thing. Many people, when they lose weight, will see their triglycerides go up. They may see their cholesterol go up and so on too. But this, it's all highly dependent on the person. And so someone who has very good micronutrient status, all the micronutrients that they need to burn energy, has good thyroid hormone status, has all the things that we would expect to promote burning energy at the liver, this person might just burn that energy really efficiently and their blood lipids might improve the whole time. Someone else who's losing adipose mass might see quite different results. They may develop fatty liver if they don't have enough choline to get rid of the fatty acids that they can't burn, so they get stuck in the liver. But if they have enough choline, for example, if they're on a paleo diet with a lot of liver and egg yolks, so they're getting lots of choline, but they're not getting enough of some other nutrient or some other factor that's needed to burn that energy, they're going to see their triglycerides go up, and they might see their cholesterol and other things go up as well. So this would be my advice. First, make sure that the difference is large enough to say it's actually increased. Second, if you've been losing weight, don't even look at your blood lipids until your weight is stable. If you're obese and overweight, normalize your metabolism, normalize your weight, normalize your body fat. Wait till it's stable for a few months and then test your blood lipids. And if it's triglycerides, make sure it's fasting. Make sure it's been the same length of time since your last meal and those things. Only then should we even begin to say, okay, there is an increase or there is a decrease that's meaningful.
Chris, thank you so much. We're going to have you back for part three, it looks like, because we're out of time for today. But we're so grateful to have you on the show. It's really exciting to get all of this super current information. And I think I tweeted this out right before we started the show. I honestly believe that if people listen to part one and part two of this podcast about cholesterol, they're going to know more about it than probably 99% of doctors at this point.
Yeah, well, I think this was a great show, and I think this is the testing blood lipids show. And if we have a part three, then part three can be, if you have all of those factors that convince you your blood lipids are actually changed, what do we do about it?
That's the cliffhanger, huh?
Yeah.
Sorry to leave you hanging, folks, but this is obviously not as simple as it's made out to be in the conventional paradigm. And we'll definitely have Chris back if he'll join us again.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Chris, and thank you so much, Danny. It was great to be here.
You're welcome. Danny, take it away.
That's going to bring us to the end of this week's episode. Chris Masterjohn, where can we find more of your work on the internet this week?
You can find me at cholesterolandhealth.com with hyphens in between the words and my blog, The Daily Lipid. And there I also post all the links to my Mother Nature Obeyed blog over at westonaprice.org. And you can also follow me on Facebook and Twitter.
Mr. Kresser, same question to you.
Same place. We're at chriskresser.com now. The Healthy Skeptic is retired, is no longer. It's all there at chriskresser.com. And then join me at Facebook, Twitter. I'm writing a series. I just published the first article yesterday on low T3 syndrome. Some of this is going to dovetail with what we're talking about with Chris on the show today about cholesterol. But if you've got low T3, but your TSH is either normal or even low, which is not the typical hypothyroid presentation, you might want to check this series out. And then I'm still finishing up the series on natural childbirth. I've got one more article to write on the potential side effects and complications of cesarean section. So look for that in the next week or so. That'll wrap that series up.
You can find all of Chris's work at thehealthyskeptic.org. You can find me at dannyroddy.com. Keep sending us your questions at thehealthyskeptic.org using the podcast submission link. If you enjoy listening to this podcast, head over to iTunes and leave us a review. Thank you for listening, and thank you for your support.